Awesome, Theo. Well, look, thanks so much for being here. This was a podcast that was recommended to me by a good friend and a mentor of mine. His name's John Elliott, and he used to be involved in the Giants. And he said, look, have you ever heard of Theo Fleury? And I was like, tell me. And he says, mate, who are you? How the heck do you not know about this guy? So he laid it out to me, and it was the sweetest podcast pitch I've ever heard in my life. And I went online and I did some research about you, picked up your book and read through some of that as well. And I was like, wow, this is definitely one that I'm really looking forward to. So there's a lot of ground we can cover today just to get the ball rolling. And I know it's a whole chapter in your book. Talk to me about Belfast. What on earth brought you to this weird and wonderful part of the world to play for a team that was really just getting on its feet at the time? You know, it seems like an odd career move for you, so I'd love to kind of hear the full story.
Yeah. Well, I was playing in a golf tournament in the summertime in Calgary with a good friend of mine. Jim Jaworski was his name. And so we're golfing and sitting in the same buggy together, and he says to me, he says, what are you doing this winter? I said, I don't have any plans. He says, well, I just bought into a team in the UK, the Belfast Giants. And he said, would love for you to come over and play for the Giants. And I was like, let me think about that, and so my fiance at the time was a dental assistant. And so I called her at lunch and I said, do you want to go to Belfast for a year? She's like, where's that? I said, it's in the UK, it's in Ireland. And she said, yeah, that would be great. So told Jim, yeah, we want to come. And I ended up arriving a little bit late in the season. We got there in October, and I believe the season starts in September, I think. And the rest is sort of history. I knew nothing about the British Hockey League before I got there, but was quickly very impressed with the city of Belfast, the people of Belfast, the fans of hockey in Belfast. The beautiful Odyssey Arena was fantastic. Mm. And then once I got to know my teammates, I always think back about, those few months that I was in Belfast, and, it was just, the hockey wasn't great, but the life experience was incredible. And, a month before I arrived in Belfast, was when I decided that, I was going to drink and I wasn't going to do drugs anymore. And so, I think I'm one of the only people on the planet who went to Belfast to get sober.
So I'm really glad you said this, because this is kind of how John pitched it to me. And I was like, what the heck was this guy Jim thinking, sending this guy to Belfast to get sober?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was it was a month just before you kind of really committed to the journey of sobriety then, yeah?
Yeah. So one of the very first time I talked to the team, I just basically said, hey, listen, I'm newly sober, and, I would really appreciate if nobody offered me a drink or, wanted me to go out to bars or whatever. And my teammates were incredibly supportive in that decision. And, it turned out to be, such an amazing experience. Not only did I get a chance to play some hockey again and be in the dressing room and, have some teammates and be a part of a team, but, it was just a really cool place. I fell in love with, the Giants Causeway and that whole area in Ireland, because every Sunday we would drive up there and I would just walk, along the cliffs there and just kind of reflect on life. And it was such a serene place that, you know, really cemented the fact that, you know, that I could do this and that I could live, you know, a sober life. So, you know, that whole area was such a great therapy place for me, to go and just hang out and you know, just think.
Class, man. So, like I said to you before we hit record, you know, we're in the middle of a series at the minute on addiction, and we've just had this incredible week where we've had the chance to talk to people from all different kind of backgrounds and walks of life who have went on some sort of a journey towards recovery. Mm-hmm. And a theme that has kind of kept popping up, and so I would love to kind of hear your thoughts on it, is this idea of two kind of paths to take, okay? First one is, like, what was your first experience of using? And I use that term really, really broadly. And what was that like for you? And then secondly, like, looking back now, you've obviously done an incredible amount of work, both in your personal life and now in the lives of others through a lot of the projects you've been involved in, your speaking, your podcasts, and all the other great stuff with the books. You know, you've got all this hindsight now. Like, when you look back with the glorious kind of 2020 glasses on your head now, like, why do you think that you started using in the first place or continued to use to the extent that you ended up?
Right. Well, so I work in the field of trauma, mental health, and addiction, okay? And they're not separate. They all live in the same house. So early on in my life, I was traumatized. You know, both my parents struggled with addiction early on in my life. So I was a part of that, and I witnessed that. And then as an adolescent, I was sexually abused for about 2.5 years. I was raped 150 times. And so that trauma left me in emotional pain and suffering. And any kind of emotional pain and suffering is mental illness, right?
Totally.
So now you have this pain inside of you that nobody can see, right? Because we're all really good at hiding, you know, our emotional pain and our emotional scars. So what do? Well, we tend to gravitate towards the dark side of life, and we get involved in addictions as a coping mechanism to suppress and numb out the emotional pain or the mental illness, right?
Absolutely.
And so, you know, that's my story. So, you know, shortly after my abuse started to happen, that's when I discovered alcohol, right? Because how many 14, 15-year-old kids who are being groomed by a pedophile, how do you come to grips with that? How do you even explain it to somebody? How do you, you know, make sense of it? And so quickly I discovered alcohol, as a great way to, you know, cope and deal with what was happening at the time. And so, you know, I always say, I became an instant alcoholic, like, almost straight away. And, you know, it was great medicine at the time, because it did its job. You know, it suppressed and it numbed out those, you know, those feelings of fear and anxiety and, you know, terror and all these things that I was experiencing at the time. And, you know, and just like every other alcoholic or addict, you know, you start with one substance and then you start to try other things, you know. And so cocaine and alcohol became, you know, like my Paxil, my Prozac, my Zoloft, you know, that I was using to, you know, manage, you know, this mental illness that was left behind from those traumatic experiences. And so, but eventually, you know, anybody who's had an addiction issue or a mental health issue and has used an addiction as a coping mechanism, you know, we always get to that place where we have to make the ultimate decision, right? And September 18th of 2005, so right before I came to Belfast, you know, I hit my knees in a washroom and And, you know, I had it out with the big guy upstairs and, because I knew I was going to die, right? I knew I was going to die. Eventually I was going to die and I didn't want to die. And because I didn't want to die, you know, I had to make some changes in my life. And, you know, it's been, hang on, I got this little app on my phone that tells me, yeah, it's 5,966 days of sobriety now. So, you know, and, it was the greatest decision I've ever made in my life. And, you know, just feel really, you know, blessed and fortunate that, you know, that I've been able to turn my life around but, you know, what happened was, you know, I think I stepped into the true purpose in my life, and that was not to be a hockey player, but to be a person, you know, who carries a story of trauma, mental health and addiction. And now, you know, being in a position to help as many people as I've been able to help through telling my own story, you know, I think has probably been my greatest achievement in life.
Absolutely. I think it's, I love how the timer is in days, you know, there's something really kind of profound about that, because it is a collection of days really, whenever you break it down. And I guess that's what all of us can do, you know, the best we can with the day that we're given. So I love that. It wasn't, you know, whatever that is in years, but it's obviously intentional the way that they laid it out like that.
Yeah. Well, because I can manage one day at a time. I can't manage years at a time. Right. You know, they say, if you think about the past, that's depression. And if you think about the future, that's anxiety. So what's the goal? The goal is try to be present as much as possible, which is almost impossible. Right. and so, you know, it truly is about trying to live in the moment, because when you live in the moment, that's where peace, joy, happiness, and serenity sort of lives, is in that space. And that's what we're all trying to achieve, you know, as trauma survivors, right? Because people who are traumatized, you know, have a really tough time staying present in the moment, right?
Totally.
Because our brains are actually damaged from that trauma. And so, you know, the healing part is learning how to retrain your brain to not think about the past and not think about the future, but actually embrace, you know, the now and, you know, stay in the moment. Because when you do that, you know, you're less stressed out, you're less anxious, you know, all of these things, you know, that people struggle with on a daily basis. And now that COVID's here, you know, that's even amped it up even more, right? Because they've taken away our ability to move, travel, you know, go to church, go to the hockey rink, you know, all of these things. And the worst place for, you know, somebody who experiences mental health challenges is to be inside of your own head.
So true.
Right. And so, you know, that's why we've seen a spike in mental illness. That's why we've seen a spike in opioid overdoses. That's why we've seen a spike in suicidal ideation and people taking their own lives, is because, you know, when you lose hope, you know, the brain automatically goes to that place.
I really loved what you said, this idea of retraining your brain as a trauma survivor. Like, can we unpack that a little bit more? Because I think everyone has a very different journey towards freedom, you know?
Right.
It seems like some people, and, you know, the rare exception, they have this experience where I hate to use the term overnight, but there is a moment where they have some sort of very significant spiritual encounter. And then the story goes, and I didn't touch my drug of choice again.
Yes.
And then there's the stories that are like, oh, that's cute. I clawed my way up the mountain stone by stone, relapsing about 40 times along the way.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have to be honest, like, my experience was the latter, and it was a very slow and gradual process. But
for sure,
talk to me a little bit about that retraining and what that looked like for you in your daily life, you know, and was that a series of years before you kind of felt a sense of, I don't know if wholeness is the right word or kind of true healing, but beyond the numbers of, oh, I didn't touch a drink or a drug since X. Tell me a little bit more about that larger journey that you've been on.
For sure. Well, I always say to everybody, it took me 10 years to get one day, right? You know, right? Because, you know, relapse is part of recovery, right?
Yeah.
You're not going to get all the tools you need, you know, right away, right? That's why we say progress, not perfection, right? But, you know, people who are traumatized are left with four sort of core beliefs about themselves. First one is abandonment and neglect. Second one is I'm not good enough. Third one is I'm not lovable. And then the fourth one, do I even exist in the world? Mm-hmm. Those are sort of the four core beliefs that you get from being traumatized. So, you know, how do I rewire that piece in me, right? How do I rewire that piece of me? Well, I need healthy, meaningful relationships in my life to help me retrain the brain where I don't feel abandoned. I feel good enough. I am lovable and I am taking up space in the world, right? And that's sort of, you know, that rewiring process that needs to happen in your brain, which takes a long time.
Yeah, and just the phrase came into my head as you were saying that was like you're giving your brain data that goes contrary to the lies that you're kind of believing about yourself. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. And when we live inside of our own head, you know, the brain is always lying to us. It's always making up shit that's never going to happen, right?
Yeah.
And so if you can get into your heart space, that's where all the good stuff is, right? That's where compassion and empathy and forgiveness and, you know, all those things that we didn't learn because we're traumatized as kids, you know, that's where you got to get to. And how do you get there? Well, you get there through helping other people. You get there through prayer, meditation, because it's a three-step process, right? I need to heal physically, emotionally, and spiritually. That's the journey, right? And every day I have to do something for each one of these three things.
Interesting.
That's it. You know, you don't have to, you know, life's a journey, right? And not everything's going to be fixed overnight, right? You know, it's a process. And, you know, it's amazing when I stand up on stage and I tell people I'm in therapy for the rest of my life. And people are just like, what? I go, well, that's how damaged I am.
Yeah.
Right. And the simple fact that I accept the fact that I'm in therapy for the rest of my life, you know, is an admittance to myself that I'm a broken person. And that kind of honesty and openness and willingness is how you stay sober, right? Every single day is because, you know, if you look at our past behavior, we're liars, cheaters, manipulators, you know, you name it, right? Because we needed to get our fix and we would do anything to get that fix.
Yeah.
Right. And so now, you know, you're on the opposite end of the spectrum where honesty, openness, and willingness has to be part of your everyday life. Right. You know, but that honesty is what connects you to people, right? That vulnerability piece, you know, really connects you to people, right? And, you know, when I wrote my book in 2009, that's exactly what happened was, you know, I finally told my story as honest as I possibly could. And what happened was it connected to other people who had experienced sexual abuse or violence or, you know, spiritual abuse, emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse. You know, they really connected to that group of people who were walking around, you know, with these secrets. And you know, this famous saying, you know, you're only as sick as your secrets. Mm. Well, when you reveal those secrets, well, you know, that's the freedom, right? The truth will set you free. And, but we've created, you know, this stigma in society where I can't tell my truth because I'm afraid of being judged. I'm afraid of being ridiculed. I'm afraid of being abandoned. I'm afraid of, you know, I'm just afraid. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's the reason why, you know, especially now that we are talking more about mental illness is because there's been people out there who have shared their deepest, darkest secrets. And that's connected them to other people who have the same story. Because let's face it, you know, take the hockey out of my story. My story is similar to most people who've experienced sexual abuse.
Yeah, it's true.
But when you finally find the courage and the strength to talk about that, that's when the healing starts.
I really am loving this, man. Like, it's just vibing off a whole bunch of stuff that I've been thinking about and speaking to other people about recently. We had a great chat with some of the guys from Alcoholics Anonymous in Belfast here, and we really got into this idea of, you know, starting the meetings with saying, you know, hi, my name's Matthew and I'm an alcoholic, and how some people really kind of push against that and say, oh, you shouldn't label yourself like that. But it's pure acceptance, you know? It's like the same way you've done with, you know, saying that you're going to be in therapy the rest of your life. Like, no diabetic on the planet would say, like, oh, like, I'm really ashamed that, I have to take my insulin. Or, you know, like, I'm just going to stop taking my insulin and just see what happens. Because it's just the reality of the life that you have. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I just think that there's a quote I came across recently. I'm sure you've heard it before. But they said, you know, reality is what you bump into whenever you're wrong.
Exactly.
And I think so often, you know, we walk around with these kind of like false versions of realities, false stories we tell about ourselves. And often it's just that honesty and cutting straight to the core with an honest inventory of where we're at and what we need is exactly what we need to kind of move forward towards any sort of healing and wholeness, you know?
So yeah. Like, not everybody wants to hear the truth, or not everybody wants to listen to your story. But what I tell people is, you know, you get to tell your story whichever way you want. Why? Because it's your story. It's nobody else's story. And the people that are judging you are the ones that you're triggering, right? Because they have the same story. And they're like, oh my God, what did I just hear? I just heard my story. Oh my God. Who knows? Mm. Who knows? Right?
Yeah.
Everybody's so afraid of being real, right? You know, like you go on social media, and I would say the majority of people on social media don't put their real picture up, and they don't have their real name attached to their profile.
Yeah.
Right? You know, so what I say to them, like, what are you afraid of? Mm. You know, because fear drives all of this. You know that.
Totally.
Right? Fear. Right? And fear creates anxiety. Right?
Those 10 years before you got your first day, what happened to bring you to the place where you could be honest about the reality of your situation?
Well, what was it? 17 years ago, I had a fully loaded gun in my mouth, ready to pull the trigger and end my life. You know? But I had to go through the process of that because, you know, the final conclusion was I didn't pull the trigger. Why didn't I pull the trigger? Because I wanted to live, right? And because I wanted to live, that meant that I had to make significant changes in my life. First one was getting sober, right? And then with sobriety comes clarity, because you're able to think properly, right? And you're able to ask for help, you know, all these things start to fall in place, right? And then, you know, and surrender is a big part of it, right? You know, and, you know, I hit my knees in a washroom and I turn my will and my life over to the care of the universe as I understand it. And ever since I made that decision, my life's been pretty, pretty great, you know?
It's funny, you know, faith and spirituality it's the foundation that my life is built on. And I try my best to be fair and represent a wide range of stories on the show. And I got to tell you, dude, like doing the series on addiction, I got to the point where I was like, flip's sake, is there nobody that's come to recovery without turning over to some sort of a higher power? You know what I mean? I was like, it just keeps coming up time and time again in stories of addiction and stories of people who've been able to achieve sobriety. Is this idea of surrender, this idea of a higher power? You know, yeah. Were you religious or spiritual before this experience in your life? Like, you know, why do you think we all kind of end up in that place of surrender?
Yeah. You're going to love this story. Okay. So I come to Belfast, right? Okay. And, you know, it's Protestant and Catholic, right?
Yeah, it's black and white.
There's a huge feud going on, right? And so, you know, each team in the British Elite League has to have 6 UK-born kids on the team, right? So they sat me in the dressing room right beside 2 guys who were young guys, Graham Walton and, I can't remember the other guy. But anyways, so I told them that I was going to Rome to go see, you know, I got invited to go to a private mass with the Pope. And Graham.
Unreal.
Yeah. Well, I was in Belfast. It was just ironic. And so I grew up, you know, I grew up as an altar boy in the Catholic Church when I was a kid. And so, so Graham says to me, obviously he's Protestant, and he says, yeah, make sure you give him a kick for me, he said. I'll never forget that. I was laughing so hard when he said that. But yeah, I grew up, you know, believing that there was something out there bigger than me. When it came to that time, you know, like I said, when I was in the washroom, and one of the things I love about 12-step is that, you know, one of the old timers came up to me one night and he said, "Do you realize in this program that you get to pick your own God?" And I was like, "What the fuck are you talking about?" You know, because I didn't have that concept, right? Yeah, I had a concept of this Catholic upbringing where it's all about shame and guilt and all these things, right? I didn't want to have any part of that. You know, I beat myself up enough, sure, you know, in my life. And so I have a really great understanding of, you know, the God of my own understanding now, you know, and, you know, I don't feel guilty when I tell God to fuck off some days, you know, and get angry at him and whatnot, you know? And so it's been really cool to go through that process, but I'm also an Aboriginal person too and Indigenous person. And, you know, I've got the opportunity to hang out with some pretty powerful spiritual people in that community. And these people have really taught me a lot about spirituality. And because, you know, it's like you said, if you don't grasp on to the spirituality part when you're trying to get clean and sober, you're going to really struggle. Mm. Right? And most people that I work with, you know, that's one of the first questions I ask them is, you know, where are you at in your own spirituality? And most of them are like, you know, have no concept.
Yeah. They're like, come again?
You know, This hockey player is asking me about God?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
You know? So.
And I love the big book. You know, the big book's so great about it in AA, where they're just like, look, whatever you can muster up to believe about a higher power, whether the higher power is the group itself, or I think I read somewhere in the big book, it was like, you know, the doorknob that, or the handle that opens the door. And I was like, okay, these guys are really open to like a broad interpretation of this. That's kind of cool. I want to come back to something you said earlier. I made a note of it because I thought it was interesting. I'm all for kind of practical tools that we can put in people's hands. And this idea of doing one thing every day in the three different departments of the emotional, the physical, and the spiritual. Do you want to open that up a little bit more and give maybe some examples of what that would look like? Because I think that's, it's so, you know, life's crazy. So to have just like only three things that you have to do on the day, you know, aside from the actual to-do list, like the real proper essential to-do list, if there's only three things on that, then I think that's something we can all get on board with. Like,
yeah, well, you know, there's a fluffy two-word saying called self-care.
Sure.
Right? That a lot of people don't like that concept, you know, when you say self-care. Well, that's part of self-care. You know, taking care of your emotional being, your physical being, and your spiritual being is part of self-care, right? Because we live in such a materialistic world that we spend the majority of our time, you know, going after success and acquiring things. Mm-hmm. And what happens is we forget who we are on the road to success or failure, whatever it is. And, you know, what keeps us grounded, what keeps us sane, what keeps us in the present is practicing those three things, right? So, you know, emotional is, you know, getting on the phone. You know, I call it find your five. So you have five people that are on speed dial and you talk to them every single day, no matter how you're feeling, right? If you're depressed, tell them you're depressed. If you're having a good day, tell them you're having a good day, right? Because that retrains the brain to be honest, open, and willing to talk about no matter where you're at. So that emotional part, or go see your therapist, go to an AA meeting or go to a group therapy session, something emotional that allows you to unload all of that emotional pain that you're going through on that particular day. Right? Physical. That means I got to move my body, which means I got to exercise. I got to eat well. I got to sleep well, you know, those things. And then the third thing is, you know, the spiritual part. So when I get up, I got to pray and I got to meditate. You know, for me, I light a smudge and, you know, go through my prayer and meditation. You know, I meditate, you know, all the time. You know, and yeah, so whatever, and you know, there's 10,000 different ways to heal, right?
Yeah.
You just have to find your formula that keeps you at peace, right? Because a lot of us have anger, resentment, you know, all of these things. And so if we're not taking care of our emotional, spiritual, and physical bodies, you know, that's going to come out most of the time if we don't, you know, relieve that pressure that builds up inside of us.
Yeah, absolutely, man.
Mm-hmm.
You talk earlier, you mentioned, you know, the many, many changes that had to take place. The first one being getting sober. In some ways, a lot of those changes that happen, because there's, you know, there's literally thousands that need to happen. Often they can kind of happen like dominoes, you know, one leads to another. It's all kind of happening. And then there's kind of that moment where like, maybe like the small little domino like comes up against like a huge domino the size of like a door. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of like, oh, this change is going to be a little bit more difficult than some of the other ones. Was there anything along your journey that took you by surprise of how hard it was to change?
No, I was under no that this was going to be easy. you know, I knew it was probably the hardest thing that I was ever going to do in my life. And, you know, I just accepted the fact that, you know, some days are going to be, you know, not a lot of fun. And, you know, but part of the process, because we ran away from our feelings, you know, I actually wrote a chapter in my second book called Sitting in Your Shit, because it's part of the process, right? I have to know what sadness feels like. I have to know what, you know, anger and rage and all those things. I have to be able to understand what that is and what it actually feels like. Because when I got into those places earlier on in my life, I knew exactly what to do to make it go away. Go find some vodka and cocaine and away it went. Sure. I didn't have to think about it. And it's that uncomfortability of sitting in those emotions is where you get the greatest growth in your life, is from sitting in that shit, right? And accepting that, yeah, this is going to happen. This is going to be a part of my life, and being okay with it.
I think that's why meditation is so
powerful
and important, because you're not trying to change anything. You know what I mean? You're just like, oh, well, look at that huge turd in the middle of my emotional being right now. Do you know what I mean? And you're just like, okay, let's just look at it. Let's just see what it is, you know? And it's really helpful, I think. And we did a conversation at the start of the series with a neuroscientist, big fancy woman called Anna Lemke, who's an expert on dopamine. And she talks about how literally whenever you sit with your pain, your dopamine receptors regulate themselves so that you're more sensitive to pleasure and enjoying life. But the more you push into pleasure, the more numb these things become. So she just talked about how it's the paradox of whenever you feel terrible and you take something to try to make you not feel terrible anymore, you're actually just putting yourself in this downward spiral. And the only way to get out of it is to lean into the pain. And that's hard, but it works.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, and that's the process of rewiring, right?
Yeah.
Is acknowledging and finding and knowing exactly what it is. Am I sad or am I angry? Right? Am I depressed or am I anxious? Right? And once we know those feelings, then we can deal with them.
Two more questions for you, mate. One is probably a bit of a dead end, but it's just a point of curiosity that I feel like I would just love to kind of hear from you. So your abuser was a hockey coach, isn't that right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'm just curious, why do you think you didn't walk away from hockey completely? Because that would be perhaps one of the possible reactions that could have happened to a child in the scenario that you found yourself in. Why did you lean into it even more? Or is that just not even something that you thought about?
Well, I didn't have any other option.
This was going to be the only way for you to kind of make it was through the sport of hockey, yeah?
Yeah, for sure.
Wow.
So, you know, from the very first time I stepped on the ice, you know, that ultimately became my happy place, right? When I stepped on the ice, I never had to think about anything else other than enjoying what I was doing and loving what I was doing, right? The only time I struggled is when I left, you know, that little 200 by 85 box, you know. I felt safe. I felt connected. I felt loved. I felt admiration. I had teammates, you know, all the things that I was lacking in my life. As soon as I stepped onto the ice, everything that I was lacking, I got, you know. And so you want to talk about dopamine? You know, that was it, you know. Yeah. That was it. And, you know, I was incredibly talented as well. Absolutely. And so all of that, you know, was like, you know, the woo-saw place for me, right? You know, and so, yeah. So I just wanted to play hockey for as long as I could, you know, and I, you know, I faced a lot of negativity, right? Because I'm not the biggest guy in the world, you know?
Sure.
You know? And everybody told me there was no chance that I was going to make it because of my size. And so that, you know, that was a, you know, fuel for me to go out there and prove everybody wrong, you know? Just like my recovery. It's the same thing, you know? Nobody ever thought that I was ever going to get sober. Well, you know, here I am.
What gives you that flow sort of experience these days outside of the ice?
Helping people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Taking people.
It's the true purpose. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, when I surrendered and turned my will and my life over, that's when my purpose for my life showed up. Right. Is when I truly surrendered, because you know, my higher power knew that I was ready for the responsibility and for the real reason why I was put on this earth.
Theo, man, last question then, just as a place to end. It's a bit of a low-hanging fruit, but I feel like it's the only way to end, really. And just simply this, you know, for anyone listening who has maybe been moved or is resonating with some of the stuff that you've shared today, whether it's on the trauma end, the addiction end, the depression end, or as you say, the three for the price of one end, as is usually the case.
Yeah.
What would you say to that individual? In what ways would you encourage them?
Yeah. Well, what I always tell people is you don't have a time machine, so you can't go back and change anything, right? But you can certainly change the future. And, you know, God has a plan for all of us. And the only time the plan goes sideways is when we're in control, when we're in charge, right? And when we give up that control and turn it over to something greater than ourselves and stick with the plan, you know, that's where compassion lives, that's where empathy lives, that's where forgiveness lives, that's where helping others lives, is in that space. But if we hang on to the past and play the role of victim, we're never going to move forward in life. Because there's a reason, there's always a reason why this stuff happens to certain people. And the gift in it is the adversity, because adversity creates resilience. And when you have resilience, there isn't anything you can overcome when you have resilience. So that adversity lesson gives you the gift of resilience. And a lot of people don't look at their trauma in that way, right? They just live in it. They use it as an excuse, all of these things. And that's what keeps them stuck in sort of, you know, in this suspended animation where, you know, nothing changes in their life. You know, they just get more angry and more turned inward into themselves, and they become more lonely. They become more depressed. They become more anxious because they're still hanging on to that traumatic event that's happened to them. And then they start to blame other people and all that. And so you get stuck in that trauma loop, right? You get stuck in that trauma loop where you can never get out. And so that surrender piece, or the realization that, you know what, this did happen for a reason, because I need to fulfill my destiny in life. And you know, the majority of people on the planet have trauma in their background. You know, you're not going to go through life unscathed. You're going to go through life where you're going to have to face some challenges. And it's those challenges that are the gift from God to teach you these lessons, so that when you come out on the other side, Now you're able to help other people because you've had the same experience as them.
Incredible. Theo, mate, thanks for the gift you've given us today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Appreciate your time, like I said, as well. So, yeah, thanks.
No problem. We miss Belfast, so.
Hey, come back when you can.
Yeah, exactly.
The Giants Causeway isn't going anywhere.
I know. Yeah. I ended up getting two dogs when I got back from Belfast, and I named them Finn and Ben and Donner. Legend. Which were the two Giants on the Causeway, the story of the Giants on the Causeway. So, you know, and I always use that saying, in the land of the Giants, you'll never walk alone.
Oh yeah. Come
Love
on.
That.
You've just Love made, it. You've made a couple of hardcore fans very, very happy.
For sure. Well, that's how I felt. The first night I went out on the ice, that's how I felt. I was in the land of the Giants.